My name is Zayas. On behalf of myself and my colleagues, Abby, Lillian, and Salem, thanks for tuning in to Neural Networks, a podcast dedicated to bringing our community closer to cutting-edge research in the fields of neuroscience and neurophilosophy. Lillian will be your host on today's special podcast episode, Unveiling the Hidden Mind for the Science Communication course in Translational and Molecular Medicine at the University of Ottawa. Today, we will be diving into what distinguishes brain from mind, including conceptually defining these terms, which are often seen as interchangeable, as well as discussing recent developments that have allowed us to apply these concepts to clinically relevant inquiries, such as on complete locked-in syndrome, or CLIS, a life-changing condition. These ideas are currently being investigated by our guest on today's episode, Dr. Georg Northoff. Dr. Northoff is a philosopher, neuroscientist, and psychiatrist, with degrees in all three disciplines. He is originally from Germany and now works as head of the Mind, Brain, and Neuroethics Research Unit at the Royal Institute of Mental Health Research, affiliated with the University of Ottawa. He seeks to answer questions surrounding why and how our brains construct subjective phenomena like self-consciousness and emotions.
Dr. Northoff, thank you so much for your time. We're truly looking forward to having you on our show. So, just to start off more broadly, as previously mentioned, you hold three degrees. Would you be able to touch on how these fields have come together and the importance of this interplay within the scope of your research?
I mean, in philosophy, it's about concepts and models. And of course, when you're dealing with something as a mind where everybody experiences, but nobody really knows what it is, you need concepts. And so that's an important thing. And in science, it's also about concept and models. So you need different models. So there's the old philosopher from the German side, Immanuel Kant, who said concepts without perceptions or intuitions, in his case, are empty, and perceptions or intuitions without concepts are blind. Because we can only research and see in our scientific data what we ourselves have as an implicit or hidden background assumption, the model. So let's say if you were traveling and you don't know that it is Europe, you will perceive Italy in a completely different way than if you were knowing, okay, it's ancient Europe and it's really old here compared to young Canada. So that's how your background assumptions impact how you perceive and see things. That's how the philosophical models impact the scientific side of things. And then, of course, as a psychiatrist, really sad thing in psychiatry, we don't have diagnostic or markers. When you go into the Heart Institute here close by, you get basically 2 days of different kinds of diagnostic investigations. And based on that, they make a diagnosis and tailor your therapy. Nothing of that in psychiatry. It's just a little bit talking. And then every psychiatrist thinks she or he knows the diagnosis, and you have as many diagnoses as psychiatrists often, because it's subjective. And so you need to understand the mechanism, and this is, of course, the coupling between neuronal and mental activity, and then also the whole philosophical side.
Yes, so for sure. It's super interesting to hear about these, you know, the modeling and how these disciplines interact in research. And so just as a follow-up question, we often hear the words brain and mind, which to maybe somebody outside of the field are thought of as synonymous. But as your work emphasizes, they are, in fact, important to consider as distinct, right? The physical process of the brain and then the more, you know, conceptual aspect of the mind. So if you would be able to touch on just what exactly distinguishes the brain from the mind.
Now I will say something which probably shocks you, but I will explain why I say this, because I think the question itself is a wrong question. Because even if you say the question of what distinguishes brain and mind, but there is no such thing. It's an illusion. It doesn't mean that you have mental states or experiences, but there is no separate entity like a mind. I think that's a real illusion. It's like, for me, this is really like the same thing. Of course, we assume, because we all have these mental states, so we experience there must be an entity underlying. It's like assuming, okay, we are on Earth, our position is on Earth, and we are the center of the universe. Yeah, before Copernicus. So same thing. We take, okay, there must be something. No, there is nothing. It's just how you relate to the world. So for me, the concept of mind is an illusion. Yeah. But it doesn't mean that I do not believe you that you have mental states. So that you have subjective experience. My research is about that. Yeah. But it's not finding a mind, or let alone saying these are different or identical. Yeah, because if you think there is nothing, then any subsequent question is superfluous. But that only congruent to the mind. It's not for the subjective experience. Like, for instance, now, the way you perceive me, and you foresee it, and you all basically have more or less the same angle on me, but you perceive me in a slightly different way. Why do you perceive somebody at all? So that's the subjectivity. That I take very seriously.
Really interesting to think of it this way. I don't think many people will immediately think illusion and the concepts you touched on. So thank you for clarifying that. What are some of the current questions or areas that remain kind of to be developed in elucidating those brain-mind connections in terms of technically defining consciousness and measuring it?
So neuroscience made a lot of advantages in the last 20, 30 years. What makes it necessary that neuronal activity transforms into mental activity? Yeah, so why? We have no idea. And that's exactly where my research and basically what I'm doing since 20, 30 years is located. So imagine, so here in Canada, you know, of course, you know, it becomes very cold in winter, so we are frozen, water is frozen, water can be fluid, sometimes also becomes a little hot here in summer. So you have three different states of the water. If you weren't knowing that this is all the chemical formula of H2O, you would say these are three different substances. And then you speculate, are these substances identical or similar or different? So we don't know the water, the chemical formula of H2O, what glues them together. And of course, that's where I have certain ideas with the space and time stuff, which you probably heard. That's basically, that's the link, this common spatial temporal features. And if your neuronal activity has a certain dynamic, certain speed, or certain spatial extension, then it transforms into an experience.
Interesting. It's a really great way to put it. That analogy is very useful just to see how it's different forms, but how are they in fact connected? And so kind of we touched on some of the papers. So we now wanted to really dive into some, you know, paper specific questions. So just this year in 2023, you published a paper titled Altered Brain Dynamics Index Levels of Arousal in Complete Locked-In Syndrome. So it discusses the implications of decoding neural dynamics, specifically in the context of complete locked-in syndrome, or CLIS, which, as we referred to earlier, is a life-altering neurological condition characterized by extensive paralysis. And so in the paper, you mentioned two specific techniques used to measure consciousness, namely power locks on it, PLE, and Lempel-Z complexity, LCC. So could you touch on how these techniques work and what trends you observe within the context of CLIS patients?
The clinical condition is really a terrible condition. So you have this complete muscle loss called amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, and they cannot move and they also cannot breathe anymore. But they often still have their little vertical eye movements. You might even lose that. So meaning, you can't communicate, but you're fully conscious. So you're completely locked in. You cannot communicate. You cannot speak. Your eyes don't move. Breathing needs to be artificial. You don't know how much muscle, for what we need the muscles. So it's really a terrible condition because I've seen some of those patients clinically. So the question is, do we have any markers, whether they're conscious or not? So meaning nothing worse is if you do something to a patient and she or he is fully conscious. Yeah, it's becoming aware, you know what is happening, and you cannot respond. Yeah, so we're looking for markers, and what do we look for? So when you're conscious, you might be, that when your consciousness continuously changes, so first the content continuously changes. Even if you're completely alone by yourself, your thought changes over time, if you let it change. Yeah, so there's a continuous change / dynamics pattern of change over time in your brain going on and also in your consciousness. So what we are looking for these patterns of change and these two markers which you indicated, power law exponent and Lempel-Sif complexity, I tell you what they are. So when you look, I like nature. So when you go to the seaside, you see big waves and small waves. Know that the big waves are very powerful. And then there are a lot of small waves. So there you see a certain structures. Smaller waves, fast, less powerful. Stronger waves, bigger waves, much more powerful, dangerous. And that's exactly the same. That's what you call scale-free activity. The same pattern across scales. And that you can measure with the power law. And you have a certain relationship. Now, when you're losing consciousness, it becomes like this. So you don't have a power difference anymore between the slower and faster waves. So the temporal structure of your waves lost. And by that, we could, in that study, really measure, basically we measure waves, slow and fast waves with that. And we see that the balance between slow and fast waves is no longer asymmetric with more power in the slower waves, but it's completely flat when they lose consciousness. So you can probably imagine that, let's say, neural waves, the seaside stuff, I always do that. Imagine you go to the seaside and all the waves are similar, always the same. That's probably what happens when you're unconscious. Because you don't perceive any differences, because no different timing, time scales are. The Lambertz of complexity, the other measure, is something basically, okay, you go shopping. You really want to buy a lot of food. But there's only a very small thing where you try to put all the food in. So you try to compress the food. Okay, the bread like this and this here, and this, so that everything fits in. That's what you basically measure by compression. You can measure the neuronal activity, how the different parts of activity, you compress them into one big shopping box and try to, and the degree to which they can be compressed or not. However, if you have five of the same items in the big shopping cart, not much compression is needed. So, but you can also maybe not compress the items. So when you, when there's low degree of compression, there's low degree of complexity, meaning unconscious. Again, everything is the same. Yeah. So your degree of compression is extremely low, slash your complexity is very low. Yeah. That's probably what these patients experience or don't experience. It's like a flat sea. Nothing changes, completely flat. No differences. And I think when you have no difference, you don't experience anything.
It's very interesting to see kind of how these methodological advancements have allowed us to better characterize these conditions, since, as you mentioned, they are very severe and very life-altering indeed. So thank you for touching on that. Just before we wrap things up, we had a closing question. So a major theme of our podcast is really to bridge that gap between the scientific realm and the public community. And so on that, what do you think is the importance of making science more accessible, and what can be done to help further this goal?
I have said often with my clinical patients, I'm a big fan of metaphors. And one thing in psychiatry is really, many people don't understand, because many of these experience, subjective experience, there are no words for it. It's non-speakable. When you suffer from a real depression, there's no words for that. The only thing is metaphors, artistic things, and that gives you an idea of what is going on. That is very important, particularly in the field of mental disorders, to really make other people understand, also the patients themselves, to make them understand this is real. So often it's already a relief for the patients when they can talk about it, or give this metaphors and you try to stipulate. So currently I'm working with one of my patients. I actually work on a project, what we call mental metaphors, where we basically do interviews, also mental metaphors, and then the patient himself, he's a movie maker. So he puts those experiences, what they tell us, into background visual scenes. So that really it's visualized what it is like. And if you know what it is like, then you can also do first better therapy. So I think that's, for me, a very important way of communicating things. So in the mind, you started with the mind, so I close out with the mind. The mind is nothing special. You saw I brought all kinds of simple daily life comparison, or even from nature. And I constantly refer to phenomena in nature, not even living species, to explain how the mental comes about. That's what I mean. We don't need to invoke anything special. Yeah, it's like before Darwin, they also said, okay, there's a God story. There's nothing special. It's this evolution, it's a natural process, how this all this develop. And same here, we don't need a special assumption that it's a mind. Yeah, that's what I think. It's very basic phenomena of nature.
Definitely agree that the use of metaphors and just making it a bit more easy to conceptualize is so useful, and great point as well about how it could involve the patients and allow us to even understand the patients beyond just within the research community. So thank you for touching on that. And that closes our interview. Thank you so much again for joining us today, Dr. Northoff. We've learned so much from your important and ongoing research surrounding brain-mind interactivity, and are certain that listeners will also.